Stephen A. Lauer, having been both inside and outside counsel, shares his thoughts on how today's lawyers should approach inside general counsel to gain their trust and their business. He currently is the director of Integrity Research for Integrity Interactive Corporation.
You occupy sort of a unique position, as far as I understand, because your background has been special. You've been outside counsel, you've been inside counsel, and currently you're dealing with a lot of issues that impact both in your position. And so I guess the first question that I want to ask you today is, how do in-house attorneys, corporate counsel, approach the issue today of engaging outside counsel, and how do they select outside counsel, and how does that differ from what might have been just a few years ago?
Well, I think Ed, the selection of outside counsel has changed in several respects. Generally speaking, I think that in-house attorneys now are looking at the selection process in a much more discerning way. They're trying to be more management-focused or management-oriented about that, and I think they're moving away from the traditional kind of ad hoc selection that you might have seen a few years ago, where for a particular matter, an in-house attorney would look around and perhaps from a list of approved outside counsel select, you know, the attorney or the firm for that particular matter, but without giving too much thought to the bigger perspective in terms of, you know, what are the other types of work that the company or law department has, how does this particular selection fit into that broader perspective, et cetera.
Well, what do you mean when you say more connected to the management issues?
Well, I think they're trying to be more, they're trying to apply management techniques and processes to the counsel selection than they had previously. And I'm thinking and referring, in a sense, to various selection tools that they had never contemplated using 10 or more years ago. Things such as requests for proposals for legal service or requests for qualifications. Even beauty contests really are not that old in terms of their use in the legal profession. So I think they are becoming more programmatic. They are trying to apply a more objective standard to their selection than might have been the case a number of years ago.
What can be objective in engaging an attorney when the relationship between attorney and client is such a personal relationship? In fact, many people have said, and I'll be devil's advocate here, many people have said that it's not the law firm that's being engaged, it's the lawyer that's being engaged,
right,
because of the rapport between the client and the attorney.
Sure. Well, and that's absolutely true. And I think to a large degree it always will hinge on a successful and positive relationship among the individuals who will be responsible for that engagement on both sides of the table, the in-house and the outside attorneys. But I think that the in-house attorneys have recognized that, as a rule, they need to, A, be more upfront about what they're looking for, what criteria will they apply when they look for that individual attorney that they want to work with and the firm. And let me take a slight diversion for a moment at least and talk about the law firm versus lawyer issue, because that is a very frequent comment and one that does have some validity. But for most companies, and for most matters, it's unusual that a single outside attorney will be able to handle the matter alone. The work, you know, whether it's a case or litigation or a transaction, as a rule, and probably in 90-plus percent of the situations, it's going to require some sort of a team. So you have to, when you're the in-house attorney selecting counsel, you have to take into account the capabilities of the firm, in addition to the individual attorney you'd be working with most directly. So even though you might choose the firm in large part because of the individual, you also have to make sure that that firm or in some fashion you've got the resources available to complete the transaction properly within that firm, or at least in addition to that firm. So you know, while you might be driven primarily by the selection of the individual attorney, you have to at least bear in mind the capabilities beyond what that one person might be able to do, him or herself.
Now, are we talking, and I presume we are from your response, that we're talking about larger law firms, not small boutiques, and certainly not sole practitioners?
Well, I think I think that as a rule, when you're talking about in-house attorneys in law departments, corporate law departments, probably more than 50% of the situations, they would not be selecting a sole practitioner. The type of work, in many cases, is probably going to require resources that a sole practitioner simply doesn't have available, unless he or she can easily pull into the team or create a team with resources outside his or her own office.
So in other words, what we're really talking about is a collaborative or a team approach, mm-hmm. and whether it's a sole practitioner, a boutique, or mm-hmm. a larger firm, if they're going to have a beauty contest, mm-hmm. and they almost always do, and I don't mean sort of a formal beauty contest,
right.
but there's a selection process that
Correct.
Everybody goes through when they hire a lawyer, even if it's one-on-one, is that you want to make sure that the people that go with you as part of your team reflect the needs and the desires of the client, the corporate
exactly.
entity.
Exactly.
And that applies both to gender as well as to attorneys of color, if the diversity issue is something that's important to,
exactly.
to the client.
You know, the list of criteria that would apply in any particular case is obviously up to the client to determine. But you're right. It could include things like gender. It could include, you know, the color of the outside attorneys, as well as other attributes, you know, their expertise, their geographic location. There are any number of criteria that might or might not apply in each particular situation, and which criteria will apply and how they apply is obviously up to the selecting law department.
Let me go back to something you said, and I don't want to hang you up.
That's okay.
But I think that you said something that was really interesting, and that is you said something to the effect that if the corporate client, the law department, the general counsel, whomever is involved here, is candid, they will detail the criteria that will be used for the selection. And that suggests to me that in some cases they're not candid or they have not been in the past. Does that fit with your experience? Is that something that you may have intended to say but didn't?
Well, I'm not sure I'd have used the word candid. I think I would have preferred to use the word explicit or, candid suggests, and I'm not sure you meant it this way, but suggests that you're hiding something, or at least not intentionally not giving all your, you know, showing all your cards. What I meant is that very often the selection was done or made by in-house attorneys without explicitly considering many different criteria. They may have, you know, gone to firms that used in the past for similar matters, but without explicitly going over, well, this case is a little different or this transaction is a little different, and should we therefore go to a different firm or a different attorney? So I think it's more, and this is what I meant by objective more than anything else. That is, you know, being more specific and explicit about what types of attorneys, what types of capabilities, what criteria they would or should use in making the selection.
Okay, Steve,
you mean they're going to use a very quantified, number-driven process.
Well, that's where I was going. You seem to suggest that there are objective and subjective criteria, and I'm wondering what are the objective criteria that a corporation might use in evaluating a prospective vendor, a law firm, outside law firm?
Well, objective criteria could include things like geographic location, bar admissions. I mean, if you've got a case that's going to be litigated in Utah, you're not going to select an attorney who's admitted only in Kentucky because that person cannot handle the matter.
Okay, but that kind of criteria seems to me to be surface criteria. I mean, that's in order to get in the door.
Well,
now we're in the door.
I mean, that's a very simple example of what I'm talking about, but you know, what are the specialties of the firm? And even let's take a firm that handles real estate. There are different types of real estate work. There's real estate litigation. There are real estate transactions. There's finance, real estate finance work. There's real estate title work. You know, a firm that handles a lot of single-family title types of transactions may not be a firm that would handle a real estate secondary market mortgage sale, even though they're both real estate. So you've got to be more specific, I think, when you're in-house these days to identify, you know, more precisely and more directly what the work calls for and how the firms or attorneys you're looking at, how they match up against that need.
Okay, let's say we have a sophisticated real estate transaction matter.
Mm-hmm.
There have got to be 100, if not 1,000, law firms that can handle that.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've done is we've identified the nature of the case,
mm-hmm.
and now we've got, let's say, 30 law firms
mm-hmm.
who have the capability.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other criteria? And it's they're geographically desirable, mm-hmm. to use a dating phrase.
Sure.
They have lawyers in the appropriate geographic spots.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm trying to do is get rid of the surface stuff.
Sure.
What are some of the other criteria that you think are objective that the law firm needs to pass muster on to be considered?
Well, if we're talking about a sophisticated real estate, let's talk about some areas where I've been involved, because I can obviously talk more fully and directly about those. If I'm an in-house attorney who is responsible for a transaction that involves the sale of mortgages in the secondary market to one of the companies like Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, Sally Mae, et cetera, the fact that and I'm looking at three law firms, A, B, and C, all of which handle sophisticated, complicated real estate matters. But law firm A has never worked with Freddie Mac, and I am selling mortgages to Freddie Mac, and law firm B has worked on deals with Freddie Mac and has established an understanding of Freddie Mac's requirements, knows the Freddie Mac guidebook on sale transactions, etc. That would be a very important consideration for me in that particular transaction, even though it may be that law firm A, even without that experience, could do the deal. The fact that law firm B has done deals with that company in the past would be at least a factor that I would look at. And that's somewhat objective criterion in this particular case. So, you know, law firm B would, in my view, you know, be a stronger candidate by virtue of its experience in that specific environment, legal environment, a little more directly than law firm A. Not to say law firm A couldn't do it, but based on the history, I'm more confident law firm B could.
Okay. In your experience, would law firm A even be in the ballpark? Would they be making a proposal to you, recognizing that that is a criterion that you would consider, and they don't have that kind of experience?
Well, I think they might be considered. I mean, obviously, you know, their strengths would have to be weighed. You know, and that may not be the only criterion, but certainly in that particular instance, I mean, I formulated that example to highlight that particular strength and the importance of that experience. So,
well, let me ask you the flip question then to that, and that is, what would law firm A have to have
to compensate
to overcome the experience factor? I mean, they are a real estate law firm.
Sure.
They just haven't dealt with Freddie Mac.
Right.
They've had other governmental agencies with whom they've dealt.
Sure.
And what would law firm A have to have in order to overcome that or compensate for that?
Yeah. Well, if it were a very large transaction and law firm A were a larger law firm and had more resources internally to devote to getting that particular transaction completed in a timely and efficient manner, and it had dealt with maybe it hadn't dealt with Freddie Mac, but it might have dealt with Fannie Mae, and they have somewhat similar approaches, then that, you know, there might be some compensating strengths there that could outweigh or at least make up for its what you might call a shortfall on that very specific criteria.
Okay.
It's unusual that you'd find, you know, if you have 10 criteria that you're applying specifically and explicitly, to find a law firm that is, you know, in the lead on every one of those 10 and all 10 would be unusual. So you're having to balance, you know, what is the best combination of qualities that I can find for this particular need.
Okay, let's assume for the moment now that you've engaged a law firm. Would you have engaged that law firm for the one matter, or are you looking for an ongoing relationship with a law firm to in effect become your general counsel, your outside general counsel?
Well, I think, again, it's probably going to vary, but I think as a rule, law departments these days are, in fact, looking for that continuing relationship, putting aside the situation where you know you only have a one-off transaction that's going to has arisen once but will probably not recur, and you need not worry about that ongoing capability. You know, you want to get this thing done. It's highly unusual, but, you know, and you look for the match there. Generally speaking, this is one way, I think, in which law departments are trying to be more management-oriented in their selection. They're trying to establish ongoing relationships and effective collaborative relationships with law firms that enable them to go back to a known quantity, that is the law firm they deal with. They've established a good working relationship, and the fact that they have established that relationship redounds to their benefit going forward. There is, I think, a very positive impact of having that good, close working relationship going forward.
So, in other words, the law firm that makes the pitch, so to speak, mm-hmm. needs to have a variety of skills to be able to handle the kinds of matters that you, the general counsel, and your company mm-hmm. are frequently facing.
Yes. I mean, a firm ought to know or do its best to find out what sorts of work that particular company and law department are involved in and are likely to be involved in going forward, so that that firm's proposal can lay out the ways in which it can serve that company most effectively on a continuing or ongoing basis.
Try
not to look at it as a single matter. I think it's to the benefit of both sides if they can look at it with a broader perspective in mind.
Of course, it's a lot cheaper from a marketing cost perspective to have an ongoing relationship. You don't have to keep selling
Absolutely.
Each matter.
I mean, the cheapest marketing is with existing clients, not new
right.
clients all the time.
Right.
So
and for the client, it's also less expensive in that there is a cost, although I'm sure it's hard for them to identify, but there is a cost connected with spending time trying to get a new vendor, if you will, a new partner in any legal situation.
There are quite a few different types of costs. Some are hard costs and others are soft costs. But even the soft costs are considerable if you think about it. I mean, the learning time that, you know, a new firm would have to spend and the delay that might create in getting the work done, because they've got to get up to speed about the client, about the business, etc., whereas a firm that has been working with a company for a period of time doesn't have that ramp-up time. So, you know, getting a particular deal done quickly is easier if the firm and the client have had an ongoing relationship up to that point. You know, there are all sorts of ways in which that existing and continuing relationship benefits both sides.
Steve, there are some terms that have been used in one format or another, and I'd like you to define them from your perspective and sort of compare and contrast, if you will. One is the phraseology partnering. Mm-hmm. Another is the phraseology collaboration. Mm-hmm. And the third is client-centered. What's the difference amongst these three?
Well, I think they're all closely related. Let me take a stab at them. A partnering relationship, I think, is one where both sides, the in-house, the law department and the law firm, view themselves as, in fact, a unitary team to get the work done. And they approach each part of the assignment with kind of a unified view of how it will be done. And they, in a sense, share the load equally, not necessarily equally in terms of number of hours will be the same on both sides of the equation, but in terms of the responsibility for getting it done. The in-house and outside attorneys work very closely and share ideas, share, you know, essentially share the resources, and work very, very closely to complete the work for the benefit of the client. And, you know, what are some of the qualities of a partnering relationship? I think, frankly, I think collaboration is one of the primary ones. That's why I think they're so closely related. But they, in a sense, share a common view of the client's needs and what the work requires. And they work very closely to make sure that it is done most efficiently and most effectively. Client-centered is certainly, I think, an important aspect of a partnering relationship, at least in terms of describing the law firm's side of that equation. And I think it reflects the reality that it is the client's interests and the client's needs that prevail. I mean, the firm is retained to serve the client's needs for legal service. So, you know, the firm has to be client-centered to, in order to best understand and properly understand and serve those needs.
So if I can paraphrase, the client-centered relationship is really something from the perspective of the law firm and what they need to perceive and what they need to feel in their gut in order to be effective and represent the client well. They have to keep the client's interests in mind, the client's not just interests, but the client's wants. And that may be a conflict because the client interest from the perspective of the law firm may be one thing, but what the client wants may be another. So
they're certainly distinct. Hopefully they overlap to a large, if not total degree.
But right. And where they differ, it's the responsibility of the law firm to bring that to the attention of the client and not proceed unless there is some harmony. Otherwise, the law firm is going to get in trouble somewhere down the road, and that's going to be reflected certainly by the refusal to pay the bill, if not worse.
Absolutely.
Let me go back to partnering and collaboration, though, because I'm not sure I understand the difference. It seems to me that those may be the same.
Well, I think, like I said, I think that a partnering relationship collaboration has to describe that a partnering relationship. Without collaboration, I don't think you've got a partnering relationship. I think a partnering relationship may be broader than that. But without collaboration, it won't qualify as a partnering relationship, in my opinion.
Okay. If there is a collaboration, let's say it rises further to a partnering relationship, now all of a sudden we've got another element in the picture in today's world being discussed by many people. And certainly I have interviewed quite a few folks in recent times and spoken at the American Bar Association just recently on the topic of alternative fee arrangements. How is it that in the partnering relationship we have sometimes still an hourly billing process, and sometimes the folks are able to talk about and implement an alternative fee? And perhaps before you get into that issue, you can define from your perspective what alternative fees are that you've seen.
Okay. Well, the simplest way to define alternative fee arrangement, in my opinion, is a fee arrangement based on something other than the hourly rate. You know, it is an alternative to the hourly rate. That's really what in-house attorneys generally mean when they use the term alternative fee arrangement or something akin to that. And I think you're right to highlight the relationship between a partnering, collaborative relationship and alternative fees, because I think it's difficult to have effective alternative fees without a very good relationship between the client and the counsel for a variety of reasons. In a sense, in a partnering relationship, each side, the client, corporate client and the law firm at least keeps in mind the needs of the other. For example, the client obviously wants, to be blunt, the cheapest legal service it can find. I mean, nobody likes to spend money on legal service, if you can help it. But at the same time, a sophisticated client understands that the law firm has to prosper. You don't want to starve your attorneys, and you want them to have the resources in terms of their staff and the attorneys and the personnel to do the work properly. So, you know, while a large corporate client might have great, terrific bargaining power in the market, it doesn't want to go too far in exercising that unilaterally and simply demanding more and more and more from the firms, because ultimately it will not be well served if the law firms with which it works can't survive.
In my experience, talking to outside counsel, their perception is that alternative fees mean cheaper fees, that it is the counsel outside, inside counsel, general counsel, corporation world and so forth, that's only trying to get lower legal fees at the expense of the law firm. And that's why a number of law firms have said they won't go forward with alternative fees. How do you respond to that?
Well, in a number of ways. First, I mean, I certainly recognize that perception out there. And, you know, I think it's a reaction to a number of things. First of all, there's certainly been a lot of talk about alternative fees as in the context of lowering outside, the amount that corporations spend on outside legal service. So certainly in terms of a gross perception, it's easy to take from that law departments are simply trying to whittle down what they pay outside firms, and that translates into an alternative fee means less being spent. But I think a sophisticated client really means by the term alternative fee one that helps the client achieve higher value for what it spends. Now, that often will translate into spending less, but not necessarily resulting in a lower effective hourly rate. If the client and the firm can figure out how to perform the work more efficiently to the benefit of both the firm and the client, then in fact the overall fee might not change dramatically in terms of its effective hourly basis.
Well, I know that one of the things in talking about alternative fees is the requirement that there be a stated objective by the client and a budgeting process or analysis by the law firm in advance of moving forward. In other words, it's not a knee-jerk reaction. Here's a complaint, now let's go defend it. You've got to put forward the concept of what it is the client wants to achieve and how best to achieve it. Then if you create a budget for that, and I did a study with a client of mine which resulted in a book and a flowchart, literally, of the entire litigation process. And what we found is that the firm had a lot of problems with collection of accounts receivables in big matters when creating a simple budget with client buy-in to that would have prevented all of that problem. So when the budget is created, then per se, I think, the amount of legal services that are offered are less in number or quantity or amount because you're focused on getting the objective and not all the peripheral stuff that goes with it as a reaction. You're now more proactive to achieve the client's objective. And I know I was speaking with Assistant General Counsel at one of the major aerospace industries a number of years ago, and she was telling me that they continued to work with a particular law firm, a large law firm, and they did a budget analysis of the case before it went forward. And they're convinced, the corporation is convinced, that they saved several hundred thousand dollars in the litigation. And yet for each hour of work performed by the law firm, The law firm got full compensation. There was no discount.
The perfect example of what I was trying to describe less specifically. In other words, and that also goes back to what we talked about before, which is trying to apply business tools within the context of legal service. I mean, budgeting was hardly ever discussed 10, 15, 20 years ago among law firms and clients. Nobody thought you could budget legal service.
That's right. And yet the clients never could understand why not in the legal context when the Empire State Building could have been built with a budget.
And pharmaceutical companies' research and development efforts are also budgeted. And talk about the difficulty of anticipating what it's going to take to do something. So budgets have been used in business for years in areas that are very difficult to predict. And for a long time, lawyers suggested that it simply wasn't possible for what they did. But now, at least, there have been efforts for a while, and I think those efforts have gained some credence and some credibility in the last few years. And you've also highlighted another point that I like to make when I talk and write about these things. Most people don't think of a budget as an alternative fee arrangement. And in its purest form, it really isn't a fee arrangement. Yet, it reflects, in many ways, more directly what in-house attorneys really are trying to do in alternative fee arrangements, because it does require that you lay out very specifically and very, very openly on the part of the client what you want to achieve in the matter, whether it's litigation or a transaction. It puts the onus on the law firm to describe how it expects to be able to meet the client's goals in terms of applying resources. These are the steps we want to take. This is approximately what it'll cost in terms of time and effort, and translate that into, a fee number. And so in the end, I consider budgeting to be a type of alternative fee arrangement, even though it's not usually viewed as such, because of the discipline that it requires you to apply ultimately results in a higher value realization on the part of the client, which is really the goal of an alternative fee arrangement.
And that's, of course, one of the benefits for the corporate law department.
Absolutely. And frankly, it's a benefit to the law department in terms of later having to explain to its internal client why it cost what it did to get the work done. If they can demonstrate the value was there more effectively, then that law department will have a much more satisfied client internally, which is a very important consideration for the law department.
And what are some of the benefits to the law firm in doing this? I know I raised earlier one of the fears, the fear of lower fees.
Well, I think that the most direct and most important benefits for the law firm of a budgeted and explicit budgeting approach are A, more satisfied client, B, more predictable receivables. Because you're much less likely to have discussions and debates and arguments about what the bill represents.
Well, I would take it a slightly different approach or rephraseology, perhaps, of what you said. It's not just a more predictable account receivable, but a more predictable cash flow. Because if you budget X number of dollars per month or whatever, you can come to an agreement with the client as to when they will pay. And if you are within budget, then there's no reason why the client should not pay. And
exactly.
So
I mean,
the predictable,
right, that the client, I mean, the client's not going to question the bill because it's within the scope of what it had anticipated and budgeted for.
Right.
So there's less likelihood of an argument and, a dissatisfied client when the invoice arrives.
Yeah, and then, of course, the other part of that you quite clearly suggest is that you've got a more satisfied client who then is likely to give you more business.
Yep.
And be a greater source of referral as well.
Exactly. I mean, law firms, I think, could very, very effectively utilize in their marketing, their success in dealing with clients and helping those clients budget their legal service. I mean, other clients will react very positively, knowing that another client, perhaps in a similar industry or having similar needs, this law firm was able to effectively budget and work with its existing clients to meet their value-driven needs as well as their substantive legal needs?
You know, I think that one of the things that I'd like to highlight here is that if the law firm does the budgeting, it's quite likely that their total revenue will be lower because they'll be able to bring the matter in at a lesser cost to the client, but it will be predictable, and therefore they won't have excess capacity, and they will then also be able to market more effectively for other business, other profitable business, beyond just this one client or this one matter.
Yeah. And they'd even have, you know, greater success in marketing to that same client for
right.
work if they've demonstrated their responsiveness to the client's, you know, budgetary needs as well as its substantive needs.
Well, Steve, I want to thank you for joining us today. And before I let you go, I want to ask you to talk a little bit about the consortium that's being created for mid-size corporate law departments and okay. your involvement in it and what it means for the future of legal services.
Well, I think the consortium is a very exciting initiative for a variety of reasons. First, it certainly is an effort, and I think ultimately it'll be a successful one, to meet the needs of law departments in to identify more effective, more efficient, and frankly more desirable law firms and vendors with which they'll want to work, because the firms and vendors involved in the consortium will have demonstrated their sensitivity to the sorts of concerns and issues that we've been discussing, budgetary needs, value, etc. It also, I think, represents what I've described as the maturation of the corporate law department as an entity or as an organizational component. That is, you know, if you look at the history of the legal profession in the last 20, 30, 40 years, the development of the in-house department and its continued development has been, I think, one of the primary attributes of that time period. And this now, the consortium represents an effort to go beyond what a single law department can do and explore ways in which law departments as a group can improve their position and improve the service available to them as a group, working in a more collaborative fashion among them.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.